This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of November 6th, here are a few top stories. In the news, one of the cities that is home to a polygamous sect on the Utah-Arizona border just had a historic election. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry reports unofficial election results show for the first time ever, non-church members won all the available seats, and the town elected a woman as its mayor.
Historically, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS, has dominated the community in and around Hilldale. And this is the first city council election since the Justice Department found the town guilty of religious discrimination last year. New mayor-elect Dania Jessup is an ex-church member.
I am feeling really excited and hopeful. And that was the whole thing I wanted to bring back, was hope. And I feel it. Everybody feels it.
Certified election results are expected in the coming weeks. Hilldale's twin city, Colorado City in Arizona, will have its city council election next year. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, reporting from Hilldale, Utah.
Now let's hear about some potential changes coming to the political scene in Arizona. Here's the show host, Mark Brody.
Arizona voters may be asked next November to change the state constitution to outlaw so-called dark money. Former Attorney General Terry Goddard is leading the effort to put the issue on the 2018 ballot. His group will have to collect more than 225,000 valid signatures by next July. Terry Goddard joins me. And Terry, what exactly are you trying to do here?
Well, we're trying to outlaw dirty money. We're trying to get the dark, anonymous funds that have been pouring into Arizona out of the dark and into the light, basically to require full disclosure of the original source of all political contributions. It's that simple.
Now, this is something that you have tried to do in the past. You had another initiative effort that didn't go very far. Why do you think this time might be a little different?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, I think a lot more people understand what a serious threat to our democracy of having big parts of our political ads paid for anonymously, what a threat that is. And the second part is we're starting a lot earlier. As you may remember, in 2016, we had a sort of a last minute effort to get on the ballot. We had some funders that decided they really liked dark money, and so they withdrew their money. And that was a false start. But I think this time we're better prepared. We've got a great ground organization. We've got a lot of volunteers that are anxious to get started. We met with several hundred of them last Saturday. And I think this is a movement that's got some real swell to it.
Do you think that you'll have the money that you need this time to get this on the ballot?
Well, it's a chicken and egg situation. Until you prove you've got a viable proposition and the ground troops to make a difference, the funders don't pay any attention. But once you show that, I think they're going to be very interested in Arizona. After all, this is a state that has a greater impact by dark money, by anonymous funds than any other state in the country in terms of percentage of total campaign spending and in terms of success. Virtually all of our statewide officials were elected with dark funds and most of the leadership of the legislature. So if any place is the high water mark of dark money in America, it's Arizona. So I think this is the place we have to make our stand.
Do you have a sense of how much money you'll need to raise?
Well, I'd like to have millions, but what we basically need to have a grassroots, largely volunteer campaign to make this thing happen in the next 7 or 8 months is, I would think, about $500,000. I think that's not buying signatures. That's just putting a really top-notch organization in the field.
Now, this effort would include, my understanding is, would include initiatives, ballot measures, whereas the one that you had done a couple years ago did not. Why did you decide to go that route this time?
Well, I think there's some important differences between what we tried before, and you've touched on probably the biggest one, which is it was just candidate elections before, and that's where most of the dark money is spent. But we felt that it was artificial to say some elections we're going to have full disclosure, other elections we won't. That really makes a false division. And so this time we're putting it against every election. Every effort to influence an election in Arizona ought to be fully disclosed. I don't think there's any ifs, ands, or buts about it.
One of the arguments against this kind of effort, as I'm sure you know, is the free speech issue, that people should be allowed to donate whatever they want to campaigns or candidates, and they don't necessarily need to let other people know that they're doing it. How do you counter that?
Well, I think we're going to hear it for sure. I mean, the Goldwater Institute and other groups have trumped that particular argument out many times. I don't think it washes. I mean, right now, for years, ever since we've had candidate elections in Arizona with disclosure, everybody who gives $20 or more has to put their name and address on a disclosure form, and it's filed with the Secretary of State. So there's nothing new about getting to disclose your identity. That's not going to stop somebody from participating. We have, however, in this proposition, we're only requiring the individual disclosures for contributions over $5,100. So if you're giving less than that, you don't have an obligation under this new proposition to give your name and address. But I think the most important thing is, in Arizona, we've given a free ride to a whole group of shadowy players that are 501c4s that are called educational foundations, but really all they are is ways to launder money in politics so that you won't be able to see who the original contributor was. And it's those C4s that Arizona has not required to make any disclosures at all. They could take hundreds of thousands of dollars from someone and not say who it is. And that's got to come to an end. That's the thing I think that has corrupted our politics in the state. I think it's given voters a sense that they can't control their own state, and I think that's got to stop.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In science news, researchers have found a genetic pattern in the saguaro and its cousins that could explain why many cactus species resist simple classification. From the Arizona Science Desk, Nicholas Gerbis reports.
Classification seems fairly easy. Compare things, see what resembles what, and arrange a family tree accordingly. But plants, like the cactus, are tricky. Distant relatives can look like twins or evolve similar traits. When the University of Arizona's Mike Sanderson and his colleagues sequenced the genome of the saguaro and four other cactuses, they found an added sticking point, a mismatch between genetic history and species history, called hemiplasy.
Since those genes can affect those traits, the fact that they have histories that don't match the history of the species means that the traits that you're looking at can actually be sort of scrambled with respect to what you might expect.
A human equivalent might involve us sharing certain gene variants with distant relatives, like gorillas, but not with closer ones, like chimps. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And thanks for listening to KJZZ's Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the KJZZ Fronteras desk, President Donald Trump's pick to lead the Homeland Security Department faced her first confirmation hearing on Wednesday. Among the questions expected for Kirstjen Nielsen, what will she do with the limbo status of 57,000 Hondurans left with an uncertain future? From Tucson, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports.
Late Monday, the outgoing DHS Secretary Lane Duke issued her edict. The temporary protected status for Nicaraguans will now end in January 2019. But for Hondurans, their date is unknown. The department will have until next July to make a decision on whether they need to also leave the country. Tom Javits is Vice President of Immigration Policy at the Center for American Progress.
So I think at that hearing, hopefully we'll have an opportunity to get her reaction to the Department of Homeland Security's inability to reach a decision on Honduras.
Hondurans and Nicaraguans who fled after the devastating Hurricane Mitch in 1998 have had their status renewed every year since. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And from the Education Desk, here's Mark Brody and Christina Estes.
The Arizona Board of Education has violated federal privacy law by releasing the names, birthdays, and AZ merit test scores of more than 1,000 students. The release appears to be inadvertent. With us to talk about how this happened and who is affected is Jim Small, Executive Director and Editor of the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Hey, Jim.
Good morning.
So what exactly happened here?
Yeah, so basically last month when the school letter grades were released, for all schools in Arizona. There were a number of schools that appealed. There were about 73, in fact. We filed a public records request with the State Board of Education for documentation related to those appeals, which consists in anything from, you know, kind of a standardized form that says who the school is and why they're appealing, along with the supporting documentation. We got those documents back. We wrote a story about the appeals and about all of the reasons that schools were claiming that their grades were incorrect and that they should be changed. And along with that, we published all of these documents for these 73 schools. Found out a week later that, in fact, there were student names and birth dates and test scores riddled throughout these – throughout mostly the supporting documentation that these schools sent to the State Board of Education. And the Board of Education has a responsibility under federal law to remove that information before they provide it to anybody, whether it's in response to a public records request from the media or if, say, that they're going to provide data to a researcher at a university who's doing a project.
So we know that that data should not have been released. Talk about how you received it and how you didn't know that you were actually putting it out there.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, like 73 schools, there were hundreds. I mean, I think well over 1,000 pages of documentation that we received. And when we went through it to do our initial story, we essentially just looked at this kind of standardized form. It was like a two or three page form that the State Board of Education basically asked schools who were going to appeal to fill out, said on there in no uncertain terms, please don't include sensitive student information, you know, but basically give us kind of a narrative as to why you think that your school should get a different grade. And we use those forms basically to assess, okay, this school is appealing because it thinks it submitted the wrong data, or this school is appealing because it thinks the formula is bad, or this one because there was some extenuating circumstances like maybe a rash of illnesses that took out a lot of students during test time or things like that. And so we didn't go through all of the supporting documentation because for the purposes of reporting on the natures of these appeals, it wasn't really that essential. It wasn't until we got contacted by a charter school administrator who said, hey, you need to take down our data because I've got students whose names are now out there and their test scores are now out there, and that's not right.
So is the issue that the schools themselves sent information they shouldn't have to the Board of Ed, or that the Board of Ed and or the Board of Ed forwarded then that information on to you when it shouldn't have?
I think fundamentally the responsibility lies on the Board of Education in this regard. You know, those schools sent that information to the Board of Education. Yes, the form said, don't include this student data, but the buck kind of stops with the Board of Education, right? Like they were the ones that maintained these public records. They were the ones responsible for distributing them to anyone who asked for them, whether it was my organization or anyone else or a public education researcher, they're all covered by federal student law or federal privacy law. It's not uncommon at all for schools to share that kind of information directly with the agencies and the boards that regulate them. The State Department of Education would be another one where there's a lot of information that moves back and forth between schools and the Department of Education, which is understandable as they're kind of administering the entire state's education system.
So what is the board saying about that?
Essentially what they said was that it was an honest mistake. It was, you know, they chalked it up to human error, that basically they'd actually created all these files, redacted, taken out all this identifying information, and when they sent them out to the media, they grabbed the wrong file folder, and said, we have the cleaned version and we have the original version, and they accidentally grabbed the original version, sent it out. They were unaware of it until, again, the school contacted us. The school also contacted the Department of Education, and I think the Department of Education informed the State Board of Ed. So it was a good week, 8 days, and after they sent this information out.
And you quickly had to take this information down, right?
Oh, we absolutely did. As soon as, you know, once I spoke to that school administrator, I went back and I looked at the files and I saw that, yes, for her school, there were a lot of student names in there, which was concerning. And then started to look through all the other files and found five other schools and much larger schools than hers that had a lot of student information. And at that point, it was not a tough decision for us to say, okay, well, this law may not apply to media organization, but it certainly is the right thing to do to pull this data down. We're not in the business of knowingly spreading this information that should be private and is private for a good reason.
All right, that's Jim Small with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Jim, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for joining us. And finally, in business news, There are some things you don't put in the trash. Paint thinner, chemicals, an old car. That's where hazardous waste drop-offs or scrapyards come in. But where do unwanted guns go? It's a sensitive topic as the gun debate rages throughout the country. And as Mariana Dale reports from KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, getting rid of a gun is not a simple or consistent process in Arizona.
Tempe couple Maria and Forrest Brown were getting ready for the birth of their first son in 1999.
I thought it was just a great opportunity to go ahead and do a little house cleaning at the same time that we were baby-proofing.
One thing she wanted out of the house was her father's .22 caliber pistol. It wasn't sentimental, and her husband Forrest says it jammed all the time.
It was a piece of junk.
So they shopped for an event where they could turn the gun in and have it destroyed. One fall Saturday, they swapped the pistol for a $50 grocery store gift card. Brown says he doesn't hate firearms.
I spent 5 years in the Army, so I'm quite comfortable with guns. I mean, I've literally slept with an M16 when I was in the field.
He still owns two, though they've been in a gun locker for years.
I just didn't want them around with the kids and, you know, didn't feel compelled to go out target shooting all that much.
He says the gun buyback was convenient. He didn't think of it as a political issue.
So back then it wasn't hard. It wasn't a problem. But honestly, you know, if you bring it up now, I don't know what you would do if you wanted to get rid of a gun.
Those gun buybacks aren't happening anymore. They're illegal in Arizona.
This has nothing to do with guns. It has to do with horrible financial management.
Charles Heller is a spokesman for the Arizona Citizens Defense League, which supported a 2013 law stopping cities from destroying government-held firearms. Instead, officials have to sell the guns through a federally licensed dealer. Without the incentive of taking guns off the streets, large-scale turn-ins have all but disappeared. Heller argues it's a matter of economics.
You're taking a public asset and deliberately spending money in order to destroy a public asset.
It's unlikely any Valley City has seen a financial windfall since the law passed. For example, Mesa Police Sergeant Diana Williams says about a dozen guns are surrendered to the department every year.
What we see really normally is we have someone where, you know, a loved one passed away. They had firearms. Now either the spouse or next of kin who's left with the property does not want them, does not know what to do with them. So then in turn, they call the police.
Non-functioning firearms are destroyed, and the others end up at Sierra Auction, a private company that sells guns in large lots online. In a statement, President Mark Fuhrer says the company records all transactions and conducts criminal background checks on people who buy their guns. Williams says if you want to give up your gun to a local police department, authorities prefer that you didn't show up at the station.
Let us come to you. Give us a call. Let us know what you want to surrender in regards to firearms. How many do you have? What types of firearms are they? Are they loaded? Are they not?
And if you want your gun destroyed, not sold, that's even more difficult. I combed the internet, talked to gun enthusiasts and dealers, and found only one group that openly advertises a turn-in program in the state. It's the Arizona Firearm Injury Prevention Coalition. Terry Allison's a member.
We didn't do it to make a big splash or to influence politicians. We did it because we felt there was a need for people to give us firearms that they did not want in their home.
He says the group started collecting unwanted guns back in the 90s. They work with police to make sure the gun doesn't have any criminal ties.
Then we do whatever the person asked us to do. If they asked us to destroy it, we'll give it to a firm that destroys firearms.
That's rare.
If they ask us to sell it, we can put it into commerce via several dealers who do this for free.
Allison says when the guns are sold, the money goes back into the nonprofit and pays for trigger locks, safety seminars, and suicide prevention programs.
We're trying to make a difference in areas where we can make a difference.
The group is diverse. Allison says he's from a pro-gun background, but now he's not sure if he believes in the label anymore.
I think I'm pro-freedom. I still believe in the right to keep and bear arms, but I have recognized over the years what a heavy responsibility that is, too.
Programs like this one won't prompt large-scale change. Instead, they give gun owners a choice they might not otherwise have. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Tempe.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.